Thank you very much, Jim, for that slightly embarrassing introduction. Most of us probably at some point in our school days encountered the idea of the Cartesian plane with an x-axis running horizontally and a y-axis running vertically, and the concept of plotting xy pairs as points on the plane, and the idea that you could have a set of points as a set of dots on a piece of paper or a line, and the further idea that there is an equation over x and y that describes that line. And the idea that if it's a more complicated equation, what it describes may not be a line, but a curve of some kind. And then the further idea that if you have an independent variable that you can plot as x and a dependent variable that you can plot as y, you can plot a curve that you derive empirically and create an equation to describe that curve. And if you consider not just the case of an independent variable x and a dependent variable y, but two independent variables x and y and a third dependent variable, then you get a plane or a surface of some kind. And those two can be described by equations. Now, having equations to describe curves or surfaces and so on is nifty because we can look at them, we can see them, and we can change them. We can perform transformations on them, simple or more complicated transformations that have sometimes predictable, sometimes unpredictable and interesting effects, just like the transformations that we can perform on images. Actually, at some deep level, they are quite often exactly the same transformations that we perform on images on our machines today, or like the transformations that we can perform on music, the kind that Evan Lentz demonstrated in the first dress rehearsal talk for Balisage on Saturday. Now, in music, those kinds of transformations are not particularly new: transpositions, inversions, retrogrades, rotation, augmentation, diminution, and so on, have been known for a long time, some perhaps longer than the standard transformations that we perform on equations, the most important of which, perhaps, or a very important one of which, is, of course, the taking of the derivative, which had to wait until after the introduction of the Cartesian plane and the calculus to be introduced, whereas musical transformations were known well before that time. Now, when trying to describe an empirically given curve, and in particular, when trying to calculate the derivative of a curve, a discontinuity in the curve is a matter of some concern, because at a point of discontinuity, you can't take the derivative. There's no definable slope to the line. And some of us remember with varying degrees of uneasiness the long discussions of Taylor expansions and the huge lengths, inordinate lengths, I remember thinking as an undergraduate, that mathematicians were willing to go to in order to avoid having an equation for a curve that they couldn't, for which they couldn't calculate a derivative. Now, when I talk about I'm not going to attempt a correct technical description of continuity, but the basic idea is simple enough. A little bit of a change in one dimension leads to a little bit of a change in the other direction. And a discontinuity is a case where a little bit of a change in one variable may lead to a very big change in another level. For example, if I take a book and I move my right hand a little bit, the book moves a little bit until there comes a point when I move my hand a little bit, but the book moves a lot. That's a discontinuity. A tipping point of any kind is a discontinuity. An avalanche is a discontinuity. Now, for things that are quantifiable, there were mathematical descriptions of how discontinuities can be described. And in some cases, you can get discontinuous behavior, even though the surface being described is completely smooth. Some of you will have read years and years ago popular science articles on catastrophe theory with diagrams like the one that I am sharing with you now. Is this visible, in fact? Can someone confirm?
Yes.
That, okay, good.
It is visible. Sorry, I'd lost my mouse.
You notice that in most parts of this surface, if you move a little bit in one direction, you'll move a little bit in a horizontal direction, you'll move a little bit perhaps in the vertical direction. But if you position yourself on the near right corner, as we look at it, of the surface and proceed left, you'll move a little bit in the vertical direction for every little bit that you move in the horizontal direction until you reach a point where for that particular pair of XY values, there's more than one value in the vertical dimension. And if we assume that there's a certain amount of inertia in the system, you'll probably stay on the upper surface. But if you continue left, ultimately you can't stay on the upper surface, because if we assume that there is something like gravity in the virtual world inhabited by this system, you're going to fall off the edge. This is the simplest of what I have read are seven topologically distinct forms of surface that can lead to the kind of catastrophic change that I was just talking about, or in fact describing. I'm not going to go into the details of those other seven shapes, because they really work only for things that can be quantified reliably, and many of the things that we're interested in here today, markup quality, technical simplicity, elegance, correctness, are tricky to quantify, which is a polite way of saying I don't think any of us has the foggiest idea how to quantify them usefully. But metaphorically, the surface that you're looking at seems to me to be relevant, because it describes an important feature of the systems we build. Often, if we need a little bit more functionality, we can get it by adding a little bit more markup. And by adding a little bit more markup, we can get a little bit more functionality and so forth. And that's part of the way many of our systems grow. But sometimes adding just a little bit more markup, or changing what looks, at least from some points of view, like a relatively small thing about the system, will lead to a catastrophic failure of the markup system. People will vote with their feet and they won't use the system after it passes some threshold value of complexity. Now, when I speak about catastrophic failure, I should point out I'm trying to use those terms in what you might call a technical sense. My father was a researcher working in the tire and rubber industry, and he spent years studying tire failure. And when we say that a tire fails, we are not engaging in a moral judgment of the tire. We're simply observing that the tire has ceased to function as designed, possibly because it exploded, possibly because it fell apart. There are many, many different forms of tire failure, and one of the jobs of a researcher in that industry is to investigate them and see if different manufacturing techniques can minimize the likelihood of various kinds of failure. And some failures are gradual, and some are quite sudden, and the sudden ones are referred to as catastrophic. So when I say that something is catastrophic, I mean that it happens very quickly and not necessarily that it makes us unhappy. Although if we want people to use a markup system and the system that we build suffers catastrophic failure, we may experience it emotionally as a catastrophe. And that's one reason that we may be interested in trying to find ways to avoid catastrophic failures. Now, I've been thinking about this largely because of several papers in this year's conference, especially the report by Tracy Elhaj and Janelle Jenstad of their work on the conversion and remediation of the editions from the Internet Shakespeare Editions Project, and also Jonathan Roby's account of markup usage in the Bible translation community. Now, in both of those cases, the central focus of the paper is somewhat broader and somewhat less gloomy, but I was struck by parallels in the two accounts. There are people doing intensive work with documents, and they work very happily with embedded markup, but they find full XML markup just too complex to use, and they don't use it. In the case of the Internet Shakespeare Editions, there was a sort of poignant account of the fact that when the Internet Shakespeare Editions project tried to take better control over its metadata and moved all the metadata out of the in-document header into a separate system where they could have stricter and more explicit markup and better controls over the markup, basically it meant that none of the editors interacted with the metadata for their editions anymore, which of course had the unfortunate effect of diminishing the accuracy of the metadata and making it worse rather than better. Michael Grick's discussion of the star format, file format for chemistry illustrates a similar point and provides a useful parallel to Jonathan Roby's description of USFM. We have in both cases a domain-specific data format that meets the felt needs of the community and for which the relevant community feels a certain ownership. In all three cases, if I understand correctly, those who do not want to work with XML object that the XML is not human readable. And also, this may or may not be exactly the same thing, that the XML representation is too complex. Now, complexity is sometimes in the eye of the beholder. Liam Quinn observed the other day that being a programmer, he was lazy. And being lazy, he wanted to avoid as much work as possible. And therefore, whenever he declares a variable in XSLT or declares a named template that has a type other than item star, he uses the as attribute of XSLT 2.0 and 3.0 to declare the type. Why? Because then the XSLT engine provides better feedback and calls Liam's attention to errors that he's made in the code so that it's easier to find the errors and he doesn't have to go looking for them quite so hard. Of course, we have probably all encountered programmers who tell us that because they're programmers, they're lazy, and because they're lazy, they are, of course, never going to use the as attribute because it's more to type. It's more verbose. It's more work for them. They prefer one kind of simplicity. Liam prefers another kind of simplicity. And we don't have to take sides in this in order to observe that there is more than one subjective notion of simplicity and more than one subjective notion of complexity. But however we perceive it and however the users of the systems we build perceive it, we need to deal with complexity. We need to control it. We need to find ways to minimize it. And I can think of several ways. Some of them are clearly distinct from each other, and others sort of bleed into each other and have perhaps multiple sliding scales. So don't take the categorization that follows too seriously. One of the simplest ways to control complexity is what might be thought of, at least by Americans of a certain age, as the just say no approach. We reduce complexity by reducing functionality or reducing generality. Jonathan Roby's account of those engaged in Bible translation illustrates that. So do Evan Lentz's style sheets for performing musical transformations. The USFM markup developed by the Bible translation community achieves simplicity of a kind by focusing on one kind of document, or more specifically, on one specific collection of documents. The Bible, as we know it in various Christian traditions and the Jewish tradition, shares some properties with other scriptural texts, but not all. So I would be a little surprised if USFM worked without any change or extension for other scriptural texts like the Quran or the Buddhist canon, and let alone something like the U.S. Code of Statutory Law. And in Evan Lentz's proof of concept, he wrote transformations which would work successfully on the Bach prelude that he was working on, but I don't really think there's any chance, and Evan certainly didn't say there would be any chance, that they would work on a work of John Cage, or even on a Bach toccata and fugue, or a different prelude. By focusing on the document he was specifically worried about, he was able to simplify the task well enough to make the translation, to make the formulation of the transformations a tractable task. That is perhaps one reason that at the beginning of the use of XML, it was really not uncommon for people to write a new style sheet for each document. The XML spec was written. We wrote a DTD for that spec. We wrote style sheets for that spec. And later, we tried to generalize the DTD and the style sheets, but the initial task was it has to work for this document. And that simplified the task significantly. And the sketch for a query language that I presented the other day similarly attempts to keep things simple by providing very limited functionality, even less than XPath 1.0. In some cases, this technique of just saying no resembles that of Procrustes, as described by Wendell Pease. If you can fit in our beds, you can sleep in our hotel. A second method of keeping complexity within bounds is to draw boundaries. Draw boundaries, restrict your attention to the area within a particular set of boundaries, keep things local. Distributed systems get great mileage from division of labor of this kind. Clear boundaries work. As Robert Frost said, good fences make good neighbors. Of course, this approach also has the property that one way for me to make my part of the task simpler is by taking a firm hold on all the complexities I can find within it and heaving them over the wall into the next plot to make them somebody else's problem. Fred Brooks describes numerous cases of this happening in various ways during the development of System 360, with people arguing over whether a particular hump in the carpet belongs over there or over there. Wendell Pease illustrated both of these techniques in his demonstrations of tools for processing local files in the browser. By doing the processing on the user's machine and not on the central server, he gives himself a sort of protected space where work can be done in blissful isolation, or at least relatively content isolation, even though distributed systems overall will tend to be more complex than equivalent monolithic systems, at least by most measures. And second, Wendell describes systems that attempt to reduce complexity for users by meeting them where they are. If the user has XML, the system will process and validate the XML. If the user has JSON, the system will process and validate the JSON. That does simplify things for the user, although it hands Wendell and his collaborators a more complicated task to solve. So we have to give Wendell credit. He picked up the problems and heaved them over the boundary into a plot for which he is also responsible. So he didn't actually just palm the complexities off on somebody else. The power of drawing boundaries, the power of modularization, is also illustrated vividly by the paper by Pietro Liuzzo on serving image data and providing distributed text services by implementing implementations as specified in IEEEF and distributed text services. Liam Quinn's talk this morning seemed to me to illustrate a slightly different form of boundary drawing. He adapts the principle of locality of reference to a subjectively very similar principle of locality of focus by adopting useful conventions that allow the relevant CSS to be specified inside the XSL template that processes that produces the output elements that the CSS should describe, rather than outside that template, even right next to it, or in a different template. He makes the boundaries of syntax and the boundaries of the region of the style sheet to which the maintenance programmer is required to pay attention coincide, and that is enormously helpful. It's also an example of encapsulation, which is one of the basic essential techniques for making complex programming possible in the first place. Named functions are a way of encapsulating bits of functionality and allowing the caller of the function to ignore, as far as possible, the details of the implementation. And when we group named functions together, we get libraries. And I think everyone interested in working with descriptive markup has to be grateful to the people who described at this conference the libraries that they are building, either for use in XSLTNX query or for use inside an XSLTNX query engine. Mary Holstedt's paper on her implementation of the Ihl-Korsak algorithm, Joel Kalvasmaki's description of his string comparison functions in the text alignment network, and Michael Kay's discussion of XenoString this morning. Mary Holstedt described the creation of a library as choosing to light a candle rather than to curse the darkness. And I think I can speak for many of the auditors when I say I felt personally a little blinded by the sheer candle power of those talks. We owe those people an enormous debt. And that leads me to the question, is there an XSLT, XQuery, XML in general, equivalent to the Comprehensive Perl Archive Network, CPAN, or the Comprehensive Tech Archive Network, CTAN, or any of the Comprehensive Blank Archive Network that have been set up for other programming languages and environments? If so, let's make sure that we get those libraries into it. And if not, shouldn't we ask ourselves, isn't it time to put one together? As Mary said, there are not as many of us as there are Perl hackers in the world, so we need to make it as easy as possible to reuse and build on each other's work. Another way to reduce complexity is by delegation, by setting up a better process, better workflow that you can trust so that you can just turn the crank on the workflow and have things work and not have it not require your full attention. And since one time-honored way of learning better things to do that is by looking over the shoulders of other people and learning from them, we can often improve our skills by listening attentively to case studies. Martin Latener and his co-authors illustrated that beautifully with their paper on the re-engineering of the XML conversion and normalization workflow at PubMed Central. Alan Bickel, Elisa Bechero-Bondar, Tim Larson similarly showed how a lot of hard work and libraries can help us grapple with very difficult, very complicated problems. Fotini Koidaki and Katerina Tiktopolo showed how much can be done by applying tools that already exist and using markup that's already specified and combining them into an intelligent workflow. I note in passing that until the TEI provided a container labeled standoff, very few people ever actually used, as far as I know, the TEI's facilities for standoff markup and standoff links. I've heard a number of talks that claim they didn't exist. It is amazing how much mileage we can get just by providing a named location and saying you can put that stuff here. Now, when the tools that we're using to build a workflow are on the new side, the experience of using them to build a workflow can be challenging, as described by Geert Boermans the other day in an inspiring talk. His choice of doing his most complex cases first is remarkably brave. When it works, I have seen that approach be remarkably effective, but it sure takes a lot of nerve. My hat's off to Geert. Sometimes it's just one particular step in the workflow that requires special attention. Sometimes we can provide library functions for it that hide all of the details, but sometimes a lot of the messy details must remain visible due to the nature of the problem. The techniques described by David Birnbaum and Charlie Taylor this afternoon for calculating the length of text in SVG, this is certainly a problem I have faced and one for which I never found a solution half as good as theirs. Those techniques can hardly hide all the messiness of the problem from the user, but they can at least help us understand where and how the messiness arises, and that in turn can help prepare us to deal with it effectively and as calmly as our circumstances allow. One of the differences between reliable mature tools and unreliable immature tools is that the reliable tools have been exposed to more edge cases and more complex situations, and more of their bugs and imperfections have been removed. To get our code to that point, it's helpful to stress test our tools. And one way to do that was illustrated by Joel Kalvismaki's 1% to 100% test cases. Another way is illustrated by Tony Graham's take no prisoners approach to replicating the typography of the first edition of Moby Dick. I do not wish to discuss with you whether you like this typography or not. I wish you, my tool, to lay it out that way. And whenever we work with tools, it's useful to know when there are alternatives and what alternatives there are. One of the things I like best about the work that Norm Walsh and I reported on in the second dress rehearsal of Balisage on Sunday is that there are viable alternatives to doing things in JavaScript. Very helpful for those of us who prefer not to have to wash our hands every time we code. One technique for reducing complexity that we shouldn't lose sight of is descriptive markup. By making the digital representation of our information match more closely our understanding of its nature, it reduces the likelihood of an impedance mismatch between our goals and our tools. It provides an opportunity for separation of concerns, identifying the boundaries of elements, identifying the types of elements, and identifying what we want to do with those elements when we process the document are all separate concerns. It's also an opportunity for delegation. We avoid the task when writing the document of deciding when a particular word needs to be italic and when it doesn't. By dividing the task and delegating to the author the task of saying what the word is, and delegating to the designer the task of deciding how it should be styled, and delegating to the formatting engine the task of actually styling it when the document is laid out. Peter Flynn gave us a master class in the analysis of requirements and devising markup to satisfy them, and ways to provide the required functionality with extremely minimal tools, up to and including kinds of resequencing of information that I would before yesterday have said were beyond any normal capacity of CSS. Patrick DeRusso's proposal for change markup takes a radical approach to a vexing problem that faces many of us. Now, since I worked for years with change markup that is inline, I will need to think for a long time to decide whether his form of standoff change markup is provocative, which is what I expect from Patrick, or merely provoking, or brilliant. Certainly, it is worth careful thought, and I plan to give it careful thought. Hugh Kalis, Thibault Cléris, and Jonathan Roby also described a proposal for improved markup to provide improved functionality, and they provide an exception to the general rule I suggested earlier. To get a little bit more functionality, they provide less markup, more compact markup. Makes you think, doesn't it? Sometimes, before you can build a tool or make a good design decision, you feel the need for more information, for more data. And Gerrit Imsiker and Nina Lynn Reinhardt presented a tour de force of sheer doggedness when you're planning for a subset exercise by examining documents in numbers that require 6 digits or more to write down. My hat is off to you. I wish I thought I were ever as thorough as that. Now, working towards semantic markup is not always simple or straightforward, and it doesn't always work out the way we might have hoped. Especially its reception by other people may not always be what we had hoped. Simon St. Laurent showed us what a long and twisting road we have traveled in that regard over the last 25 years. And as he said, it is a bittersweet story. It's also bittersweet sometimes it's just infuriating, when we get blindsided by things that should be simple in theory but aren't simple in practice. Because we need to remember, hiding complexity only helps if what we're hiding is the complexity of a solution to a problem. It doesn't help if what we're hiding is the existence of the problem. Tommy Usden started the conference with a firm reminder that using descriptive markup is not, in the current state of the universe, an invest and forget kind of operation. Software-independent descriptive markup eliminates some kinds of data obsolescence, but it does not in itself guarantee data longevity. To achieve data longevity, active work is needed. Ari Nordstrom illustrated this point vividly with his account of work on using topic-based techniques with SGML-encoded data. The encoding designed years ago turns out not to be a clear, crystalline representation of the absolute information content, but also to contain a generous admixture of assumptions about the surrounding technologies and the way they will work or should work. To take the simple example of image embedding, there was a time when lots of people would feel it more natural to have declaration before use. So the idea of declarations of entity declarations before use by means of entity references would feel utterly natural. Since the popularity of the World Wide Web, of course, most of us are more used now to being able to refer to any URI without any prior declaration. And those will represent two different styles of markup and require two different styles of processing. We can still read the old data. It's just that current tools aren't set up to deal with data encoded that way because nobody does it that way anymore. Similarly, some people want declaration before use, because it makes at least theoretically possible that a system can read the declarations and say, you know, I'm not successful in retrieving these entities. I'm going to fail now and not burn a lot of CPU time performing work that cannot be completed. Early failure is very important in some contexts. But again, some people, it is now perhaps more common for people to say, well, I'd really rather that the system try to muddle through, because frankly, I may stop paging through the document before I reach that figure anyway. So it really, in that case, it really doesn't matter whether you retrieved the image entity or not. Now, some of the problems identified by Tommy Usden and Ari Nordstrom are not peculiar to descriptive markup. Digital resources of all kinds require much more active interventions by libraries and archives than paper materials normally do. Some of the best preserved collections of older books in Europe are in out-of-the-way libraries that lacked funding, where the stacks were unheated, and sometimes the windows didn't even have glass. As long as the windows were far enough away that the snow could not blow in and fall on the books were just fine in the cold. Actually, it turns out that's one of the best ways to store books for longevity. It's also good if they're not disturbed for years on end because nobody actually goes to this library because it's in a small, out-of-the-way library. If something turns out to be hard in practice, although in theory it should be easy, then really what those of us interested in theory and practice ought to do is rethink our theory. That's hard, but it's an important task. Sometimes our best efforts to be guided by our understanding of the problem can misfire. Josh Lubell gave us a concrete example in his talk about how the model made him do it. The application Josh discussed illustrates an important point about markup and about IT design in general, and also it seems to me about ontology, although you'll have to ask Alan Rainier about that. There is often more than one way to organize the information in a system, and very often more than one way to identify the entities that need to be represented by objects or things or XML elements in the system. Case in point, Josh created a tool for tailoring security baselines, which had no unitary representation of a baseline in anywhere in its XML representations. Now, that design did not lead to any logical contradictions. The only symptom of something amiss was that some operations the user needed to perform were more awkward than Josh would have liked. Robin LaFontaine helped expand our minds in a similar way by his discourse on the fact that fixing a sequence for elements can be viewed as a signal that the sequence of elements carries no information and does not matter. And conversely, that leaving the sequence free is a signal that the order can carry information and therefore does matter. And he went further. He tied the issue of significant or insignificant variation in sequence to the concrete application of document comparison. And in so doing, he made me aware of aspects of the issue and complexities in the issue that otherwise had never occurred to me. And I'm grateful to him for that. Stephen Pemberton showed us that if you think hard enough about it, you will find that what look at first glance like quite different problems, constraints on atomic values and constraints on document structure, can in fact be reduced to a common foundation, which gives hope to those who appreciate the declarative power in X forms and hope that it can be given even more declarative power. One of the reasons that philosophers sometimes have the reputation of being gadflies is their propensity for trying to rethink things that the rest of us do not regard as being in particular need of rethinking. This effort is particularly fraught when it's not clear that the understanding that satisfies the rest of us was, in fact, the result of much serious thinking in the first place. Is it possible to rethink something that hasn't been thought out properly first? Alan Rainier and Bonnie Mack have posed a difficult question by asking what's going on in presentational markup. One of the challenges of the question, it seems to me, is perhaps that it's not entirely clear what counts as a solution, so that in order to answer the question, you both have to answer the question and you have to invent the rules of a game which will make your answer count as a satisfactory answer to the question. I mean no disrespect to Alan and Bonnie or to any of the other authors who've presented their very good work here when I say that the rethinking that I think may have the greatest implications for document representation and document processing is the rethinking described by Ellie Blaker, Ronald Heintjens-Dekker, and Bram Bautendijk in their paper about thinking about text in trees and graphs. One of the most important lessons I think we can learn from their work on text as graph and TagML and Alexandria is that, as Ellie Blaker said, we should not take the electronic representation of our documents for granted. We need to bear in mind that they invariably involve choices, which could be made in other ways, and that choices that seem perfectly reasonable at the time can, as Josh Lubell's paper illustrated, make it harder to do some things with our data and thus impose an unexpected tax on those who need to do those things. That's potentially a problem in any application domain, but it is perhaps particularly intolerable in scholarly research. So we have a sort of contradiction or complementarity. One way to reduce complexity in our lives is to make certain things routine, make them automatic, so they require no thought from us. We can do them mindlessly. But another way to reduce complexity, equally essential, is to remain mindful of our choices and to remain open to learning from experience and making other choices. Thank you all for making this a balisage with such excellent lessons about how to achieve both routine reliability and mindful contemplation of the information we work with.
Oh.